It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the lead up to next week's election has seen lots of misinformation spreading. We'll learn more about the impact it has and how to push back against it. First, last month, at the site of a school shooting in South St. Louis, the teenage perpetrator left a note in his car, which the police commissioner shared some of during a press conference. The note referred to a lack of friend and family connections and feelings of isolation. Our next guest has studied the psychology of school shooters and found that those feelings were common threads. And while those feelings can't in and of themselves predict a school shooting, they may offer insight in ways to prevent them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about why school shootings happen, what they have in common? Do you work at a school? What is the administration, the staff doing to help address things like mental health and bullying and isolation among students? Call in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Robin Kowalski is Centennial Professor in the Department of Psychology at Clemson University. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You've done a lot of research on these issues. And one thing I want to get at the start is something you're not saying we can do. The idea I think we get from TV that we can profile, that we can have a psychological set of characteristics and say, aha, this person is likely to become a school shooter. Why is that so difficult to do?
That's exactly right, because there's not a, you know, there's not a one size fits all model. And, you know, you mentioned the bullying and you mentioned the mental health issues. And, you know, the research that we found has shown that there are indeed certain, we'll call them correlates, or, you know, maybe antecedent conditions, maybe predictors. But, you know, there's a lot of children who are bullied, for example, mm-hmm. Young people who don't go on to become school shooters. There's, you know, so many young people who have mental health issues who subsequently do not go on to become school shooters. So while those factors are correlated along with some others, you know, that doesn't allow us to profile somebody just because they have those particular features as part of their, you know, their well-being.
That said, that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. When you study people who end up becoming perpetrators in schools, and you've also looked at colleges, are there themes you see that we could say, yes, if we could treat the student body as a whole, if we could change the experience for them, that we might help prevent these situations?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, let's stick with what we were just talking about with the bullying and the mental health. You know, so you just said that we don't want to profile and we can't profile, but we can deal with some of these underlying conditions. You know, at least in the state that I live in South Carolina, and the state law is that schools have to have some kind of anti-bullying program. So I go and speak to a lot of different schools, maybe an hour-long presentation, but me going and talking about bullying for an hour, that should just be the beginning of, you know, a 9-month long, or for you know, schools that have a year-long program of bullying intervention. You know, for mental health issues, there should be mental health programs. And part of that should be what, it's a relatively recent field in psychology, which is focusing on psychological mattering. You know, what can we do to increase the likelihood that children and young adults, and adults for that matter, feel like they matter, you know, feel like they belong. We've done some recent research also showing that, you know, feeling that you don't matter is correlated with suicidal ideation and potentially suicidal attempts. So this concept that mattering is important and that belonging is important, you know, and that feeling marginalized puts people at risk for all sorts of things, that's where schools need to devote some of their attention.
I wanted to key in on that idea of mattering, of feeling like people are worth something to other people. How can a school cultivate that kind of feeling in all of their students?
So there's several ways that, and some schools are already doing it. I do want to point that out. There's some schools throughout the country that are already paying attention to this. There are buttons that say you matter, and they'll have, you know, students wear those buttons, or they'll pass them out for anybody that wants to wear them. There's one school in Long Island, and they have each student create like a puzzle piece that, you know, basically, you know, if I were to create my puzzle piece, it would show what makes me unique. And then they put the puzzle pieces together. And what it shows is that, you know, you can't have the entire puzzle without each of the individual pieces, each of the unique pieces that make up the whole. And that makes each person feel special and realize that in spite of the fact that each person is maybe different from another person, or have their own quirks or eccentricities or things that make them, you know, stand out from other people, that you know, the really the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. So that's a good example of a way that schools can go about making young people feel like they matter.
You mentioned that mental illness in some cases can correlate with the risk of a school shooting, but not necessarily be the cause. I wonder if, is this a second order thing where if I'm a kid and I'm dealing with a mental health problem, and that is obvious in some way to other students, and they, you know, maybe with meaning to maybe not exclude me, there's that lack of mattering. There's that isolation that can become a problem.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that makes the person with the underlying psychological problem feel like they don't matter and that they don't belong. And, you know, there's sort of an antecedent and a consequence issue. So it can be the antecedent, but then as a result of, you know, children who maybe have anxiety or depression to begin with may even behave in certain ways that lead them to be marginalized. But then once they sort of distance themselves, then the other children or young people at the school feel like, oh, they're different. I'm not going to, it just becomes this vicious cycle.
With this focus on mattering, on making kids feel like they matter, obviously the percentage of children who end up being involved in these shootings is very, very small. Do we get benefits outside of preventing, say, a school shooting or, as you mentioned, suicide prevention? What are some of the wider benefits of this focus on matter?
Even if we weren't talking about school shootings, everybody can benefit from a focus on mattering. You know, it takes so little to make somebody feel that they're important, to make somebody feel that they matter, just a small act of kindness. You know, I teach an 8 o'clock class every semester, and, you know, these are college kids, and I tell them regularly, more than once a semester, you know, that before we come, it's a small class, has about 25 students in it, and I tell them that, you know, we have no idea what any of the 26, counting me, 26 of us have gone through before we even walk in that class at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it's just, you know, all it takes is just asking somebody how they're doing or just a small gesture. It takes so little effort to make somebody feel that they matter. And again, without knowing what somebody's going through, that little effort can make all of the difference, whether we're talking about school shootings or just making somebody feel like they belong, or maybe somebody's going through some family situation. But those things also can tie into, you know, we have sort of key, you know, correlates that we know tie into school shootings, but we know that many of the school shooters have also had family problems and, you know, a whole host of other issues that play into it. So again, the mattering, whether we're talking about school shooters or not, that mattering can play into every situation.
We're talking to Robin Kowalski, professor of psychology at Clemson University. She's helping us understand some of the underlying conditions, situations that can lead to school shootings, how we can better identify and address them to prevent more shootings from happening. And as she's saying, get other benefits for kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This idea of making kids feel like they matter at home, in school, is this something you've run into? Have you made an effort to do this as a parent, a grandparent, a teacher, a school counselor, or a fellow student yourself? Are you seeing these kind of ideas in your school? What questions do you have for our guest about how this all works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about underlying social and psychological conditions that can make school shootings more likely and how we can prevent them from happening. Robin Kowalski is with us, professor of psychology at Clemson University. She's done a lot of research on this over the years. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at school for you or your kid. Do you feel like there was a good environment where people felt like they belonged? What can make it better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions, or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin, hopefully we create these environments where a potential school shooting isn't about to happen. You've also looked, though, at some of the red flags, the warning signs. What can school communities, you know, teachers, parents, fellow students watch out for to suggest that something might be happening in the near future?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So in the vast majority of cases, there are, in fact, warning signs, but so often they're ignored. We often use the phrase leakage to refer to those warning signs. And it could be that maybe the person who ultimately becomes a school shooter has created a video, or maybe they've left a note, or maybe they've written a journal. Oftentimes these appear on social media, or maybe they've, on their social media profile, they're posting, you know, images of guns or, you know, that weren't there, you know, they hadn't been posting like that before. Maybe they're bragging about plans that they have, you know, maybe they're just disclosing to one or two of their, you know, acquaintances or friends what they're planning to do. And there's, you know, in schools, oftentimes there's this code of silence where, you know, I've heard this, but I really don't want to say anything. Or maybe other students aren't taking it seriously, but it needs to be taken seriously. But even if it is, maybe there's this fear of, oh, well, you know, maybe I really do believe them, but I'm afraid that, you know, if I tell and they find out that I'm the one that told, you know, maybe I'll be putting myself at risk. So one thing that schools can do is they can make an anonymous reporting system where students who hear something or see something who are afraid to make their identity known can report what they have seen or heard to school administrators without revealing their identity.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Mequon. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
Well, it's a wonderful topic to talk about, but what my feeling is, and a lot of these, like that last suggestion is really kind of good, but what I would say is that people that have mental health, and especially kids that have bad situations at home, the teachers can help in that they recognize it. But I think it takes a team of people and a lot of effort. It's nice for kids to say, hi, how are you, and that sort of thing. But kids that are rejected because they're different, they're going to be rejected. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of thought to help those people. And it probably takes a team of people. And as a former educator, I'll say, number one, it takes a lot of money, but there are no quick fixes. And I think great reporting if you see a kid like that, but expecting kids that are not different to make a difference I don't think it's impossible, but it's pretty hard.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Robin.
Yeah, so I don't disagree that it certainly takes a village. But, you know, I would encourage the caller to watch a TED Talk that's called I Was Almost a School Shooter. It's about Aaron Stark. I would encourage all viewers to watch this TED Talk. It's super powerful. But Aaron Stark talks about he had a horrendous home situation. And he was really suicidal. He had plans to shoot up his school. And he had one friend that reached out to him. And I'm not saying that that's going to, you know, that one friend is going to work for everybody, but at least in that particular case, it did. It's a very, very powerful TED Talk. But I think that the caller makes a good point. It certainly takes, mental health issues are certainly not easily dealt with.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. Lynn also brings up a resource question. Do schools have enough resources to devote to, you know, creating that welcoming situation, to providing more help to that kid who needs it?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that schools have done, and we want to be careful that we don't exacerbate the mental health issues with some of the attempts we make to intervene, you know, like with lockdown drills and, metal detectors and things like that. And I don't want anybody listening to this to misunderstand what I'm saying. I think all of those things are very beneficial. But there's also a lot of research to suggest that particularly for young kids, like in elementary school, some of those things, particularly lockdown drills, can increase the anxiety of the children. And we also need to remember that most of the time the school shooters are coming from within the school itself. Sometimes they're a former student, like in the case of the St. Louis shooting, but they're going to be, you know, with the drills, the shooter's going to be, they're learning the drill at the same time as everybody else.
Thanks again for that call, Lynn. Robin, if somebody's listening who's involved with their school as an educator, an administrator, school board member, whatever, thinking, yeah, I'd like to do some of the things you're talking about. I'd like to boost this idea of students mattering to one another and to the community. What would you recommend as first steps?
You know, Again, there's some schools that have already done it. So one thing I would recommend is that you know, the administrators do a search for schools that are and programs that are already out there that have been very successful in promoting it. Most of these programs are not ones that cost a lot of money, because, you know, you made the point about schools don't have a lot of resources, and so many schools now don't. So the programs that I know about that, you know, have implemented programs related to Mattering are not, they're not requiring a lot of financial resources, but they seem to be meeting with a lot of success.
And how would those, if people adopt these programs, what does that look like? What kind of things actually happen in a school in just our last minute and a half or so if they adopt one of these Mattering programs?
In terms of what they're actually doing, or mm-hmm. what the effect of it is?
What they're doing, yeah.
Well, you know, just earlier I mentioned like the jigsaw, obviously it's a huge jigsaw or multiple jigsaws where the children are made to you know, not only for the student, him or herself, but for everyone to appreciate the uniqueness and the specialness of other students. In another one, in another school, one thing they do is, you know, because everybody's experiences are different, so it's called the Cross the Line Challenge. So they will have students, and they'll start with fairly innocuous questions like, you know, how many of you, I'm just totally making up some of these questions, but, you know, are over the age of 10 or whatever, and then they cross the line. But then the questions get more more detailed and more involved and more personal. You know, how many of you are children from divorced families? You know, because a lot of times when children are struggling with things, particularly at home, you know, they feel like they're the only person who has experienced that, and that they feel like that sets them apart and makes them isolated. But then when they engage in the Cross the Line Challenge, they realize that A, they're not alone, and B, that there's other people, other young people, their peers, that they can talk to about the issues that they're struggling with.
Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Robin Kowalski, Centennial Professor in the Department of Psychology at Clemson University. She joined us today for a look at ways to address some of the underlying conditions that she's identified as factors that correlate with school shootings, and how to create better school environments to hopefully prevent them from happening in the first place. The Wisconsin Republican Party reports that its list of election workers to staff the polls is 3 times longer than it was in 2020. It's a sign of emphasis on election logistics following former President Donald Trump's false claims that the election of 2020 was stolen. As Wisconsin Watch's Jacob Resnick reports, election officials say they're doing their best to reassure voters that the state's upcoming elections will be fair and secure.
Oconto County Clerk Kim Pitleski keeps a series of colorful, hand-drawn posters in her office. On one, she's written in marker, "Perception has become reality." It's a nod to the way election officials like her have come under serious, sometimes ill-informed scrutiny. She wants to reassure people that votes aren't being stolen, despite what they might read on social media.
People are throwing skepticism and these comments out there, but they're not doing the homework on what this really entails.
Frontline election workers are encountering not just questions, but outright hostility. It's fueled by former President Donald Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. Milwaukee election officials report receiving harassing calls, even death threats, leading officials to beef up security. The Madison metro area is preparing too. In Stoughton, clerks will have trauma kits and training for active shooter scenarios. City Clerk Candy Christian says Dane County had recommended these precautions.
It's a balance between trying to get our poll workers aware, but also not scare them away from being a poll worker.
One part of the Wisconsin Republican Party's response to the 2020 elections has been to invest in what it calls its Election Integrity Unit. In Green Bay, Brown County Republican Chair Jim Fitzgerald says historically, Republicans didn't recruit many poll workers.
When I came into office 4 years ago here, the list of poll workers I had were probably 90% unaffiliated, with very, very few Republicans. That's just the way it was done back then. You know, you try and have identified Republicans, but it wasn't that big a deal.
But it is a big deal now. And it goes back to what the county clerk in Oconto has said. Perception has become reality. Fitzgerald says his party needs to reassure its base angry about Trump's defeat.
The issue has never been the 2020 election with us. It's been as a result of the 2020 election and as a result of how people reacted to it, we have to take care of their reactions.
And it's not just symbolic. Wisconsin election law allows whatever party's presidential or gubernatorial candidate that got the most votes at a precinct to nominate an extra election inspector at that polling place. That extra poll worker could be a tie-breaking vote if there's disagreement over whether to accept an absentee ballot, questioned on technical grounds. The Republican Party says it sent 5,053 names to local clerks to work the polls, and that's a threefold increase over 2020. State Democratic officials wouldn't say how many party members they've signed up, but they point to their voter assistance hotline for anyone encountering problems at the polls. And while Republican officials may deny that they're focused on 2020, it's clear that some members of the party are angry about the chaos from voting during the first year of the pandemic. Marge Bostelman was county clerk in Green Lake for 24 years, and since 2019, she's been a Republican member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. She says her experience as a clerk has guided her votes on the commission, even when it contradicts the party line. Things came to a head last year after she voted with Democrats to allow nursing home residents to vote absentee.
They wanted to make it clear that the Green Lake Republican Party denounced me because of my actions on the WEC.
A year later, the lifelong Republican is unrepentant for her work on the commission.
I'm not going to follow what the party wants me to do if it's detrimental for a municipal clerk to run a fair and honest election.
Back in Oconto, Republican County Clerk Pitt Leske says she's worried about this increasingly winners-take-all mindset in politics.
Because pendulums swing. You know, who's in power, so to speak, that will swing. And we want to write election laws that are in place no matter which political party has the majority, because we all have to play by the same rules on this. Play nice in the sandbox.
Because even in her rural county, political polarization has pitted some neighbors against each other. And she says we can't let our communities be divided this way. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jacob Resnick in Oconto.
Coming up after the news, false stories circulated about the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband Paul before the official police reports even came out. We'll talk to a misinformation expert about how these conspiracies spread, what effect they have, and what, if anything, can be done to slow the spread of bad information. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our conversations with candidates running for state attorney general. We'll talk to Republican and current Fond du Lac County District Attorney Eric Toney. Now, misinformation is spreading rapidly in the lead up to the midterm elections. Beyond just misleading info you might expect to see in a political ad, some candidates and other public figures have shared verifiably false stories. Some candidates have shared urban legends, like a debunked conspiracy of schools letting students use litter boxes in school bathrooms. Others are more serious, like false rumors about what led to the attack on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, over the weekend. We're looking at the sources and the ecosystem of the way these false stories spread, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you encounter these conspiracy stories, these false stories about real things going on in the world? Do you push back on them when somebody shares them with you? Do you have questions about how these stories spread? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Dominic Stetsua is an assistant professor of political science at Colorado State University. He studies political communication and behavior in the news media environment. Dominic, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Let's start with this most recent story, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, attacked a chilling attack, a break-in in his house, hospitalized afterward. And before the police reports come out even, we see false stories spread based on pretty much nothing, making claims that turned out not to be true. Can you talk about this story and how it illustrates what you've looked at in the past when it comes to the spread of misinformation?
Yeah, there's this one's a troubling one, but like you say, a lot of these things kind of come out of nothing. And I think it's good to kind of keep a perspective on these things, right? Like, there's always been misinformation. There's always been conspiracy theories. There's always been people who are kind of more prone to believe this kind of content than maybe straightforward and more complex explanations. But social media really kind of amplifies a lot of this stuff, allows it to spread a lot faster. And when you add political polarization to the mix, the fact that we're really kind of very tribal these days, we really don't like the other side, that creates certain incentives and certain demand for especially political misinformation. So I think this is really the confluence of two of these things, where, you know, the reality is that, you know, a person stormed into Speaker of the House's home and was trying to locate her. You know, some people called it an assassination attempt. The perpetrator himself mentioned that he didn't want to kill Pelosi, I guess, but he wanted to hurt her kneecaps or whatever. But however you look at it, this is just a very troubling instance of political violence, and kind of making light of the situation and kind of coming up with conspiracy theories really kind of amplifies the kind of the polarization and this other kind of misinformation on social media aspect of our current reality.
In the past, I might have expected things like this to be kind of on the fringe. We see in some cases, you know, sitting members of Congress sharing some of these stories, or we worry about social media. The new owner of a social media outlet, Elon Musk, on Twitter for a while had shared one of these made-up news stories about this. Does it make a difference that prominent, wealthy, or connected political figures are getting in the game now and sharing these things?
It certainly makes a difference. That's really the most troubling part of this whole situation is, like you said, you know, historically, these kind of views were marginalized, right? People would kind of exchange like newsletters or something, maybe gather at the Radisson by the airport or something once in a while. The fellow conspiracy theorists would kind of come out of the basements and kind of gather together and discuss their shared views. But this wasn't out in the open. This wasn't out in the mainstream. And it certainly wasn't promoted by important political or kind of cultural figures. That phenomenon really makes it a lot worse, right? Elon Musk tweeting essentially like a fake news site article about the situation makes a big difference because he's an influential person. He has a big following. President Trump's son, Donald Jr., tweeted a very tasteless kind of joke at the situation. That matters. A lot of Republican candidates, right? Governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, made fun of the situation. Aspiring political candidate in Arizona, right? Carrie Lake talked about this. When we have so many political and cultural elites amplify misinformation, it really makes a difference because a lot of the public opinion formation really comes top down, right? We tend to follow the leaders. We tend to follow the people who we trust, who we can identify with. And this really makes a big difference. It allows it to become more mainstream, and it makes it okay.
One, I guess, tactical advantage that misinformation has, and I've been watching this since, you know, a lot of school shootings years ago where in the media, we can only talk about what we know is happening. So a lot of people are hungry for information and refreshing news sites and seeing nothing change and nothing change. But if somebody wants to make up a story and put it out there, they can do it as fast as they want. So that ends up having, in some ways, a competitive advantage. It gives new, not information, I guess it gives a new read on the story while people are maybe bored with the news outlets saying the same thing. Is that still, that asymmetry still there?
I think part of it for sure, right? There's different motivations why people create this content. Like I mentioned earlier, part of the motivation is frequently political. Part of the motivation is kind of driven by how polarized our politics have become recently, how amped up and kind of dialed up we always are about politics, especially among people who kind of follow the news and get engaged in the public sphere. So there's this political motivation to it that serves as a motivator for kind of creating maybe some of this content and sharing this content for some people. But for other people, it's not really political, right? It's financial. So when you kind of go back to kind of our interest as a society in misinformation, a lot of this got got really started in 2016, right? And the kind of the fake news that emerged during the presidential election cycle and the kind of made up stories, for example, like the one about Pope Francis endorsing Donald Trump, which obviously didn't happen, that story getting a lot of traction on social media, especially on Facebook. So that kind of sparked our interest, right, in this whole topic. And kind of who came up with that story, right? A lot of the 2016 misinformation and fake news was created by essentially unemployed teens in Macedonia mm-hmm. who were making up news content, trying to come up with charged political news that would make people click on the link, go to a site in order for them to monetize Google ads from said sites. So the motivation for them wasn't really political per se. They created content for both the left and the right. It just the content on the right spread more on social media, so they were able to monetize that better. So there's all kinds of considerations here, right? Some people just want to make money and want to essentially take advantage of how polarized and kind of vulnerable and gullible some people are. Other people, it's more of a propaganda thing, motivating the base, trying to really make a difference politically, and acting with political goals in mind. So it's just a very complex landscape, really.
We're talking to Dominic Statsua from Colorado State University, political science professor there, looking at the spread of misinformation always and in this lead up to the midterm elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think could work to slow the spread of misinformation? Do you push back when you see a false news story maybe shared by someone you know on social media? Does it work when you do, or does it just start more arguments? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up a conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Dominic Statsua, assistant professor of political science at Colorado State University, with us today looking at how misinformation spreads quickly and what we can do to push back against it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. This topic really hits home with me. My father is a Christian, hard worker, honest man. And he would always forward these emails, about Trump and all this stuff, all this fake stuff that I would reply and show the actual truth, whether it was Snopes or the full video, things like that. And I would be like, you know, they keep sending you stuff that you know is false. Why are you listening? And, what... Don't you realize that they have an agenda? And because of that, I don't trust Republicans at all, and I'm very angry. I haven't talked to my father in almost a year now.
Jackie, thanks. I'm sorry to hear about that difficult time in your family. Dominic, are there effective ways that individuals can say, hey, that thing you're sharing, it's false?
If there was one simple solution to this problem, I would love to share it with you. But unfortunately, there isn't one. Having a good faith conversation, trying to kind of reassure the person that you kind of get where they're coming from, maybe reassure some of their values and beliefs, without kind of attacking them, without ridiculing them, can help. But a lot of these things are just deeper, right? It's not really about the misinformation, that specific piece of misinformation per se, right? So frequently people have this tendency of just kind of correcting that information and hoping that just giving people the correct facts will matter. But it's not just about the facts. It's about the underlying values. It's about where that information is coming from and the purpose of that information, including misinformation, right? And frequently it serves this important purpose of reassuring somebody in kind of their political values, their political beliefs. It makes them feel good to be Team Republican or Team Democrat. And when you're faced with these kind of more identity-based things, right? This isn't just about beliefs. It's more about identities and who you are. It's very difficult to correct this thing. It's very difficult to kind of persuade somebody that they're maybe wrong. It's certainly worth to have a conversation. It's definitely worth to try to engage and really have a good faith discussion. But frequently, you will not end up persuading even your loved ones, because it's just a very difficult situation with many layers, including psychological and political motivations that are just so difficult to crack.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Randy joins us now in Roberts. Randy, hi. Are you there, Randy? I think we lost him. Let's try Blake in Mosinee. Blake, hi.
Hi, I was just calling to talk about how I view, certain platforms like TikTok and YouTube and, other social media content. And I kind of noticed how certain platforms like this, they kind of have a tendency to, send people through certain tunnels, I guess, would be the only way I could describe it.
Sure.
You view the content that you're going to be most likely to watch for longer periods of time. And I think that kind of stems into people, say if they're a Republican, they'd be watching more content that it,
I gotcha, Blake. Thanks a lot for that call. Dominic, the algorithmic rabbit holes that some platforms send us down, how important are they to some of these false stories spreading?
So I don't think we should overestimate their importance, because ultimately there is a lot of demand for misinformation, right? And there's some research on that showing that even when platforms like Facebook go down, for example, I have a research project where we look at what happened during the outage of Facebook last year. What ended up happening is there was skyrocketing traffic towards some known peddlers of misinformation, such as InfoWars and other websites like that. So there's a lot of kind of underlying demand for this stuff. But rabbit holes and algorithms definitely make things worse, right? We have to remember that these platforms are free. And when something is free, frequently you are, as a user, the product, right? Your attention is what's being sold to advertisers, right? So these platforms essentially have a vested interest in ensuring that you stay on for as long as you can. So they look at your behavior, right? They look at what you're more likely to kind of engage with, what you're more likely to share, to comment on, to like. And then they send you down that rabbit hole frequently. And I think that's definitely something that happens on something like YouTube. I'm less familiar with TikTok. Part of the reason why we know less about TikTok is because they're just less likely to share any kind of data with researchers. But I think there's definitely some of that happening, and that doesn't that doesn't make things better. But ultimately, it's essentially going back to the ecosystem of information right now, right? And if our attention is being monetized by these platforms for the purposes of selling ads, they have a vested interest in doing whatever it takes for you to be on the platform. And frequently what keeps your attention, what gets you engaged, right, what makes you comment and share, is not really the neutral or balanced content. It's the most extreme partisan, overhyped content, right? That's really what gets people motivated. So when you consider these incentives, it's no longer the information landscape looks the way it does.
Thanks for that call, Blake. And just our last few moments, Dominic, you mentioned there's no one easy solution here. What would you see as the best starting point to try to turn the tide against this bad information?
I think we can do a lot as individuals, being vigilant, being skeptical, being aware of the fact that we're frequently, people are trying to kind of capitalize on our partisan political commitments. So just being vigilant, remembering that, just because something we see online exists and maybe it reinforces some of our beliefs, that doesn't mean it's true. So really being careful about really pressing that share button or retweet button, really being, thoughtful about double checking before we share something. If nobody is really, none of the verified websites, right, none of the verified news outlets actually report on a situation you found posted on Facebook, then it's probably too good to be true or maybe made up. So just be vigilant. And I think in general, just really altering some of your news consumption patterns, really maybe going back to some traditional, especially local news sources. So maybe avoiding things like cable, right? Avoiding maybe the depths of Twitter and YouTube.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Dominic Statsua, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Colorado State University, with us today looking at how misinformation spreads so quickly and how to turn things around. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in La Crosse. He's one of the people featured in a new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted.
A group of musicians are jamming in their living room in La Crosse. One of the musicians playing is a Cuban exile who arrived in Wisconsin following the Mariel boat lift in 1980.
Okay, well, my full name is Marcos Andres Hernandez Calderon. Very, very long name. I have to deal with that for the rest of my life.
Marcos was born in 1957 and grew up in Havana. And when he was about 12, he got paid to wash and park cars across from the luxurious Hotel Capri.
And they have a garage in there. And I got together with a lot of all those older people. And they play chess and dominoes and all kinds of things. So they were paying me, you know. It probably was, if I remember, 35, 40 cents, something like that, for washing the car. But I get to drive it. And my dad was helping me steering and all that. And after that, I love driving.
As he got older, he wanted to really hit the road. Marcos dreamed of traveling, visiting countries around the world. But he couldn't, because in the 1960s and 70s, President Fidel Castro placed tough restrictions on leaving Cuba.
You cannot leave the country to visit it anywhere, to come in here and go back. And one for Fidel Castro, the communists take over, and then Cuba becoming a prison. That's what I like to say about that.
Then 1980 hit. Castro changed course and allowed residents to leave the island for the United States from April to October. Marcos and 125,000 other people saw this, the Mariel boat lift, as their opportunity to get out of Cuba.
My mother was the first one who told me, you better get out here because you have no future here.
Marcos hopped on a boat, heartbroken that he was leaving his family. He landed in Florida and was quickly whisked away to Wisconsin, where he joined almost 15,000 other Cuban refugees at Fort McCoy in Sparta. He was there for less than a month when he eventually moved in with a family of farmers before moving out on his own. And he got a job with his first love, cars.
I drive many different type of transportation out there. I drive for handicap buses and vans and limousines.
But then in 1988, Marcos got caught with drugs. That conviction sent him to prison, and it's still impacting his life today.
We were not aware of the consequences, you know. So we were thinking of the money, you know, just like pretty much everybody until you get caught. I still paying for that mistake, you know. They got me under the...
Because of that mistake, a felony conviction, he cannot become a permanent resident or citizen of the United States.
1991, I got out, and since then, all I have done is work, and no crime, nothing, and no second chance.
And the hardest thing for him, he can't get a passport to travel the world or visit his family in Cuba, people he hasn't seen in more than 40 years.
If I have the chance to go back home, you know, the person will be going to the cemetery where my mother is buried and giving my, you know...
Living in legal limbo for decades has been difficult for Marcos and many of his other Cuban friends who arrived in Wisconsin in 1980.
Enough is enough for people that pretty much have been in this country more than they have been in their own country. I want people to hear a voice. I want people to know they... I did have a dream to come to this country and go pretty much to everywhere in the whole world, you know. That dream is still pending, you know.
To learn more about Marcos's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, and to find out why his desire to return home is urgent, check out the new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes can be found at wpr.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Surf's Up in Wisconsin. Check out the past, present, and future of surfing on the state's Lake Michigan shoreline. I understand winter is the surfing season here in Wisconsin. I guess bundle up warm. If you have surfed in Wisconsin or off the shores of Wisconsin, share your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Bad dreams, nightmares, are no fun. Most of us have had them at some point. Some people have them often enough that it's considered a sleep disorder. One new treatment in very early stages could give them some help with a little music. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, a common treatment for chronic nightmares is to have people visualize happy dreams when they're awake in a guided, focused session. Seems to help many people, but not everyone. So here's this new research published in Current Biology. In the study, people with regular nightmares do that visualization practice, and while they're imagining a happy dream, they hear a musical chord, a major chord, at regular intervals. Then that same chord gets played at regular intervals while they're sleeping. In the small study, participants report that A, the musical sounds didn't wake them up, and B, their dreams were actually better. Now again, this is a small study. Don't take it to the bank just yet, but low cost, low risk, not a lot of side effects. Why not give it a try? The healing power of music, this is Central Time.